I am having so much fun putting these podcasts together. It's a wonderful excuse to reach out to old friends I haven't talked to in a long time. Just like the last recording with Amy and this one with Megan Leslie. Megan and Amy actually grew up together in Kirkland Lake, Ontario, and all of us went to university together. Megan went on to become a member of parliament and is now the president and CEO of the World Wildlife Fund. I love this conversation. It was a lot of fun chatting with Megan. I hope you enjoyed as much as I did.
Matthew Groudon.
Megan Leslie, what have you been doing with yourself for the last 25 years?
Yeah, it's been 25 years. Well, I graduated from undergrad.
I didn't.
You know what?
Yeah.
Neither did I.
Yeah, okay.
Then I went to law school.
Oh, they want you to have a degree.
No, they don't. But I was partway through law school and I was like, Jesus, Megan.
Jesus.
Like, you don't even have an undergraduate degree. What kind of imposter are you holding yourself out to be? So I actually finished my undergrad during law school, which was bananas. But can I, we can edit this out, but if you want. But so I graduated when I was in law school. I couldn't go to convocation because that was back at York and like, who wants to be on stage with 10,000 people? But my friends at school organized a convocation for me that involved wearing a gown made out of a garbage bag. They printed me a fake degree. My friend David pretended to be Lorna Marsden, the then president of York University.
Amazing.
And they all sang whatever that convocation song is. As I walked through the law school bar, we had our own bar.
Like, not the bar, but the bar. The drinking bar.
In my garbage bag. Anyway, it was a whole scene.
I love that. That's amazing. Those are real friends you had there. Like, we were shitty friends at York, but it sounds like, yeah, you met some nice people at law school.
Thank God.
I explained this in a previous recording, I didn't finish, and there's a much longer story that I won't bore anyone with, but you remember, my mom was sick. There were things to do. I needed money to pay to live, to, you know, afford things. And I went looking for a third part-time job. But instead of getting a third part-time job, I got 3 full-time job offers. I was like, why am I going to school if I can get real work doing real things without an actual degree? And that seemed fine. Actually, it still is fine. Don't tell the kids. Don't tell the children about that. But so I never needed, there was only once in my entire adult life where I got kind of jammed up, where I was up for a role, I was up for a job. This company sought me out, which is kind of the funny part. They sought me out. They're like, you have skills. We need you. I'm like, great. And then we're going through kind of the references and due diligence. And they're like, you don't have a university degree. You can't work here because we're an academic textbook company.
Come on.
And we had standards. And I was like, are you kidding me? Because it's not my degree in English literature that's going to help me ship more of your books.
So here is the thing. I work at a conservation organization now. And when we think about equity and diversity in hiring, and we think about the fact that we are trying to promote and support the work of Indigenous communities who are leading in conservation. So what, I'm going to hire a bunch of McGill Masters of Biology grads? Like, no, I'm going to hire people. No offense to McGill. But like,
sorry, McGill grads.
Just pull that out of the air. But I'm going to hire people who know how to do this work. And by not centering the hiring around what degree you have, you actually get some really interesting people applying. You tend to get more diverse candidates. And you can actually attract Indigenous, First Nations, Inuit, and Métis candidates who might not want to leave their home community and their home supports, who might have like this incredible view on how conservation needs to be done, but they don't have that master's of science, right? So it's an equity issue as well.
Interesting. I don't think that ever factored into my hiring. No. I lived most of my adult life up until now without a university degree, but then during COVID, I got bored working from home. Mm-hmm. And I needed things to fill my day. And so I started picking up things to do. And the first thing, this wasn't supposed to be about me, but here we are talking about. So the first thing I picked up to do was I got a voice coach and I started doing voice lessons, singing lessons.
Amazing.
Over Zoom. And that was a shit ton of fun. And now there was even like, as COVID kind of wrapped up, there was actually even a, there was a school recital. So I had to go and all of the students had, I got to sing on stage at the Alma Combo. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. But among the things that I picked and chose to, you know, insert something between workday and night so that I knew that the day ended, I called up York and I was like, how do I finish this degree? What do I need to do? And the academic advisor was almost insulting because they're like, normally students of your, and she was going to use the word, and then she popped like, of your
caliber,
vintage. Of your era, don't know how to sign on to our online portal. I'm on the page waiting to put in the course catalog number for this course she said I need to take. And blah, blah, blah.
Do you know who I am?
Well, I thought, I was like, okay. So, and
I worked at the computer lab
on campus. And that's not what I said. I said, at that time, this was a true statement. I was like, I work at Google. And she goes, oh, so you didn't need this degree. I'm like, no, I didn't need it then. I don't need it now. I just like, you know, I'm looking for a thing to do and I like reading. So let's get together. Let's hang out. Let's read some books.
I love this.
Yeah. So, and then so many good stories. The whole thing was asynchronous. So I never went to a classroom. I never saw another fellow student. I saw a lot of weird conversation in some online forums that the university organized. But my professor, I've said this in the recording I did with Amy as well, but my professor had office hours and I went to the office hours and I was like, so does anyone ever show up? And she's like, no one ever shows up to the office hours. I'm like, can I have them all? Can I go to every office hour? Because I'm bored at home and I'm looking for something to do in my evenings when work is theoretically over. And she's like, yeah, you can have them all. Come to all of them. It's okay. So it was just me and the professor meeting once a week.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And now I have a degree. I have a degree in English literature. Thank you. If you'd like to talk poetry, it turns out I really like poetry.
No, I don't want to do that. Thank you.
Well, okay. Back to you. So, so you didn't finish, but then you did finish and you had met some lovely people at law school. And then what happened?
How deep do you want me to go on this?
I don't know. We got some time.
We got some time. All I've ever wanted to do was work on the issue of justice. And for me, justice is economic justice, social justice, and environmental justice. I didn't go to law school because I love the law. I went because it's a tool. It's a tool to be able to work on these things. So I did legal aid for a while, working on issues affecting low-income Nova Scotians. I lived in Nova Scotia, worked on human rights issues and tenant right issues and welfare rights. And then an opportunity came up to put my name on the ballot to become the candidate for the NDP federally in Halifax. I did that. I secured that nomination. And then I became the member of parliament for Halifax.
And that was really exciting. I mean, I remember we exchanged a few messages.
We did, yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember if it was like the Facebook or email. I was going to be in your neck of the woods and I was trying to get you to come out to a pub that I was hanging out at one day, but you were, you know, being all parliamentary. You were busy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was a wild time because a lot of people don't think about this. Parliaments in Ottawa, you represent people in a home constituency, there is an incredible tension between those two places, right?
What?
You want to be, it's almost impossible to manage because you want to be home as much as possible, but you also have these parliamentary duties. So yeah, I was in Ottawa Monday to Friday for like basically the school year, September to June.
Right.
Which was intense.
And we also talked about how, and I don't know how that happened and it isn't true anymore, but because you were there and because Larry Miller from my hometown also a member of parliament, it was like a weird moment in time for me where I'm like, I actually know like personally know two members of parliament for that. If I have any reason to, you know, write a letter or talk to anyone, that could be super valuable, but I don't. So saying I happen to know two members of parliament right now. This is funny. Larry was a good guy. He was a good guy.
He was, he and I were friendly.
Yeah.
I was from a, I'm from a small town in Northern Ontario as well, even smaller than, well,
no, your think town is bigger than Wyre. Wyreton, Kirkland Lake? Kirkland Lake, are you?
Yeah. Is it bigger? Okay, anyway, it's further north.
It is further north.
Oh.
Yeah.
And Larry was, when I first, so I was elected an NDP in a minority government, and the Conservatives were government, but in a minority. And so when you think about the House of Commons, everybody on the right of the speaker is government, on the left of the speaker is opposition. But when it's a minority, we spill over. Right. So I actually sat on the government side, like the rump, with, so to speak, with a bunch of Conservatives. And I sat very close to Larry Miller. Wow. Our politics are diametrically opposed.
Yeah.
And I was this, like, you know, little gal with, like, you know, riding her bicycle with the baguette in my basket, you know, and he was this, like, big gun toting guy. And he was mouthing off about something. I would say this in front of him. He was mouthing off about something, something about people in cities and the NDP and guns. And I turned around. I was like, Larry Miller, I got my first gun when I was 12 years old. And he was like, oh, well, you're okay then. We became friends.
Amazing. That's amazing. That sounds right.
Yeah.
That sounds right. So member of parliament, Halifax. And then not. Yeah.
So I lost in 2015. I lost spectacularly.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, better to lose and be wiped off the mat than to question how you could lose by two.
Sure. Sure.
Every single seat in Atlantic Canada went Liberal. And so I went out with that Liberal wave.
Weird. And then you were
weird.
Weird. And then you were in charge of oceans, which I love as a job description.
Yeah.
Oceans.
Vice President of Oceans.
Very important. Like,
yeah, this is a step down now that I'm CEO. It's like,
are you still in charge of oceans, or is that relegated to someone else?
Yeah. The oceans report to me.
Oceans beat. They report to
me. I took on a short-term job at World Wildlife Fund Canada. And that short-term opportunity turned into another short-term opportunity. And then when the CEO stepped down, went on to other things.
Moved on.
I applied for the job of president and CEO, and I've been in this role since 2018.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's pretty fun.
Yeah.
And about justice. Like, politics for me wasn't about politics. I wasn't, like, super into politics at the time. I am now, but it wasn't, I know a thing or two.
But
didn't really know much about what I was getting myself into, but was like, this is another platform, another opportunity to do that work that maybe not everybody has the opportunity to do. And then at WWF, you know, yes, we're an environmental organization, but there's this real understanding that if we're going to achieve conservation wins, we have to include people.
Right.
And that we have a role to play in reconciliation through conservation. This idea that you could restore the lands as an act of reconciliation just, like, makes my heart burst, you know? So anyway, just continuing to work on the same issues, I guess.
Right. It's just an extension of the same thread.
Yeah, for me anyway.
That's really, really amazing. I've spent a little time poking around the WWF.ca website, as you do. Or as our mutual friend Amy would call it, farting around on the internet. I've been farting around on the internet, just like Amy does. And I got stuck on, and I downloaded the report, the carbon landscape mapping report.
Yeah.
I mean, I love a good PDF. I love a good PDF. So I downloaded the report, but I will admit I'm not sure I understand what I'm looking at. So can you tell me what I'm looking at?
Yeah, it's an intense report. And but it serves a purpose. It's not a report for report's sake. So, you know, maybe in grade 5 science or social studies, you remember that your teacher would have talked about how trees store carbon. They breathe in carbon dioxide and they exhale out oxygen. So we have this sort of like basic understanding of things. It's true. But the thing is, ecosystems store carbon writ large, not just in trees, but in all the plants, in the bushes, in the roots, and then when those plants and trees die, they get integrated into the soil. Soil, healthy soil, is so rich in carbon. And so what we wanted to do was figure out, well, what are the stores of carbon in Canada's ecosystems? Are they significant? Do they matter? Where are they? So working with McMaster University and a few other folks, we did this analysis of ecosystem carbon, so carbon in the landscapes, using LIDAR, using drone technology, using, I should have studied up on the tech. You're going to catch me so flat-footed.
Come on, you're doing fine. You're doing fine.
Generative AI.
Generative AI. We made fun of this when I was at Google, because it's sort of like, could you get through an entire conversation or presentation without saying the phrase, like, we use, you know, previous vernacular, we use machine learning, we use generative AI too, and then fill in the blank.
Come on, have pity on me. Like, this is not my world.
But I read this. So you're collecting all this data through drones, satellites, satellite?
Satellite
LIDAR,
imagery, yep.
And then you used machine learning.
Yes. To like, how high are the trees in this area? Because we know the trees are like this kind of tree versus that kind of tree, this kind of peat versus that kind of peat. And mapped out ecosystem carbon in Canada. And it's like, it's a showstopper. It is a showstopper. Like, first and foremost, the high level takeaway is there are globally significant stores of carbon in Canada's landscape. Globally significant. Well, who cares? Why is it significant? Well, if you think about, when we look at greenhouse gas emissions, 30% of our greenhouse gas emissions come from the destruction of nature. So when we drain a wetland to put, an Amazon warehouse on it, when we open up the green belt, these are just examples I'm pulling out of the sky. Who would do this?
Theoretically, you're saying.
Theoretically.
Like, you don't have anything against McGill students. You're not actually slagging Amazon.
I love McGill. But when we're doing these activities where we're not just cutting down trees, but draining wetlands or digging up peatlands or, you know, we need farms, but are we using landscapes and turning them into farms or mines or whatever it is? The carbon that's in that landscape, it gets converted into greenhouse gases. So that conversion of carbon globally, not just in Canada, but globally, is 30% of our GHGs. So cars, yes. Trucks, yes. Heating, yes. Conversion of carbon. So when we look at this map that we created, it shows you where the carbon is. So if you can picture in your mind's eye Hudson Bay and James Bay, underneath it, when you look at this map, it's deep, dark red. So those peatlands have thousands and thousands of years of accumulated carbon. And if we think about something like the Ring of Fire, that's where it is. So those peatlands are under threat because the Ring of Fire has all of these critical minerals. Yes, some of those critical minerals are things that we will need to transition to the green carbon, the green economy of the future. But if we just go in without a plan and dig up all this peatland, we will be detonating a carbon bomb. So mapping out where the carbon is incredibly important. We can think about protection differently. Like, you think, okay, well, we've protected areas of Canada because they are good examples of a particular ecosystem, because there's certain wildlife there that we want to protect their habitat. What if we protected for carbon? What if we said, this is so important, we actually need to protect carbon? When you look at the map too, you'll see, red is rich carbon. I think yellow and light yellow is low carbon. If you look at the prairies, there's like a square, almost a perfect square of no carbon. What's that about?
Farming.
Right.
And it's already been extracted.
Already extracted.
Years of farming.
So potential for restoration through a different kind of farming, like regenerative farming, or thinking about how we can maybe give some of that back to restore to nature. Anyway, the mapping was incredible. It was a kind of a watershed moment for us in understanding ecosystem carbon and the role that we have to play in potentially protecting it, potentially restoring it. One of the issues with it, or problems, shortcomings, I think, is it's static.
Right.
This is a moment in time.
Right.
Now, it is interactive. Anybody can go in. We can give you the secret code so you can get into, like, I think it's something like, you know, 1.5 meters. You know, you can say, what's the carbon in my backyard? We can get down to pretty amazing resolution. But it is static. So we're experimenting with some technology companies right now on how we can have cheap, accurate, user-friendly technology so that communities can go out and do this for themselves. So in interior BC, you might remember in 2017, there's always big fires in BC, but there was this big fire in an area called Elephant Hill. It burned for 3 months, 200,000 square kilometers, just not burned, seared. Like, this stuff doesn't regenerate. You know, the seeds have just been seared. And so Shepwetmekulu Restoration and Stewardship Society, an Indigenous-led organization, they are looking at, you know, human restoration, getting the restoration going. But if they plant this tree, if they plant that tree, is it taking? Is it surviving? What are the carbon benefits? How can we measure? So they're in there with these technologies experimenting with us to actually measure what's carbon before, what's carbon during, what's carbon after, so we can, you know, demonstrate that this is possible.
That is super cool, super interesting.
Fun.
I mean, the thing that struck me looking at the maps was really surprising was the carbon that's in soil, the amount that's in, you know, as we say, peat or in moss or in the ground versus, because you think when you kind of have this framework and you're like, okay, right, trees, and we got a lot of trees. There's so many trees out there. But that is not nearly as dense a carbon mass as the soil.
Yeah, and it's been a while since I've talked about this mapping in detail. I think we only go down 2 meters.
Oh, wow.
In our analysis.
So there's more.
Exactly, yeah. Especially peatlands, right? Like, they're so deep.
When you think about, you know, so I wasn't necessarily going to talk about this, but you mentioned it, and I think that's super. I read this article on the weekend that they were talking about how in North America, in the U.S. in particular, that the first wave of environmentalism was really conservationism.
Mm, yeah.
And that we're in a new era of environmentalism that conflicts with some previous legacy views of conservationism in that there are things we need to build. Like, there's sort of this, like, there's certain, this element of to save the planet, we're going to have to do some things that we wouldn't have previously considered as this particular action has an environmental outcome, right? As was kind of the argument of the article, which I'm still frankly chewing on. I'm still like, that's a lot to read on a Saturday morning. But when you comment on the Ring of Fire and we talk about, like, the extraction of minerals or something, and I know this is probably way deeper than you expected to go in this conversation right now, but the trade-off between the exercise of pulling something like lithium out of the ground to put it into batteries for electrification versus preserving the stored carbon in something like the peat moss that might be on top of, or even many layers deep that we haven't measured down to, on top of those minerals. How do you think about that? Like, how does talk about, you know, you personally, and talk about how the organization thinks about that?
So going back to that idea of conservation being like the beginning of this environmental movement, I think a lot of the conservation lens historically has also been harmful.
Right.
There's been, so has everything.
Right. We get things wrong all the time, it turns out.
Yeah. With conservation, there's this historic tendency towards fortress conservation.
Right.
Is that what we call it? It's like, this place is special. We're going to put a fence around it.
We're going to put a fence.
It's too special for you. It's too special for you. Like,
no one gets to see it anymore.
No one gets to see it. Yeah. So special. And that's ridiculous because, like, we're human beings and we live in nature. And anyway, we can't extract ourselves. It doesn't work that way. I think that any modern conservation, the conservation that we're doing, any conservation we're doing needs human beings if it's going to be durable, if it's going to be accepted, right? Like, people need to see themselves in this work. And so to see yourself, you need an economy. You need a way to survive. And even the smallest things, like, you want a place to bring your kids to, go run around, like,
go hiking, go camping.
Yeah, go hiking, or like just sit under a tree and calm down. So from the minute to the economy, right? So when we look at conservation, there has to be this balance between people and nature. We don't have like a, party line at WWF about like, okay, exploit this area, but don't exploit that area. Right. But that is a real consideration, right? There are a lot of degraded lands in Canada. So when we're looking at building housing, can we build on areas we've already torn up the nature?
Right.
There is a lot of landscape for mining. Can we be precise in those approaches? Can we have precision in our environmental assessments to say, okay, yes, but only here? Here, consequences too big. There, okay, put some safeguards in place. Like, it doesn't have to be black and white. And it does take some negotiating in your own brain too, right? There are some places that are special enough. Not that we need to put fences around them, but that they, if we screw them up, there's sort of no going back. And I would argue the peatlands in southern Hudson Bay, southern James Bay, like, that is a carbon bomb. We can't screw it up. A lot of, we work with the Meshkegawag Council, which is a council of a lot of the First Nations along the shores of Hudson and James Bay. And they talk about how their elders call those lands the breathing lands.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah. And like, beautiful. And, that's not a traditional notion. That is what they've embraced now. And it's a big deal. It's a big deal.
I saw, shortly after I read that, I also saw an example, again in the U.S., where somebody built a brand new solar farm on a former quarry. Right, so they basically we already tore this land up.
Yeah.
We already wrecked this piece of land. But now we can repurpose it. And because no one, this is a perfect use case, perfect example where, we ripped all of the whatever out of here, quartz or whatever, gravel. I don't know. What do people use? What are quarries for anyway? But Stone. But there are a lot of quarries around my hometown. It's all stone. But the fact that then that could be is kind of like a perfect candidate for something like a solar farm is really interesting, thought exercise, because there are so many of those places that we just haven't considered, that we just like we've forgotten about because we already ruined them, but we put a fence around them to
account. Yeah. Exactly. So there's that piece. And then I would argue there's an opportunity with the flip side of it. For example, in interior BC, those fires I was talking about, and I'm talking about a very specific area, but this is territory of Shipwapmik people. They have documented their oral history about what the forests looked like pre-contact. It's extraordinary.
Wow.
This is what they look like pre-contact. And that is really important because many of our forests, not all, many of them are not forests as the way you and I think of an ecosystem, right? Messy, and there's shrubs and vines, and there's like all these different plants. They are farms for toilet paper. It's not glamorous, right. But they are, you know, a few species of trees that have been planted on purpose, that are managed purposefully to then cut them down, because we make a lot of toilet paper in this country. Forests are supposed to be messy and diverse and have all these different species. When we think about some of these forest fires, they're burning so fast, so furious. It is not entirely, but sometimes can be attributed in part to the fact that they are not diverse. They're not damp. They're not messy. They are just a few species managed for yield. And in this case with Shapwatmukulu Restoration Stewardship Society, they're seeing this as an opportunity. It's like some of the forest on our territory was kind of fucked up.
Is that a technical term?
Was conservation term.
We've done the analysis.
Yeah.
And this place is discernibly fucked up.
And they're like, okay, how do we bring it back to what it should be? And,
or as I like to call it, how do we unfuck it?
How do we unfuck it?
Right? How do you unfuck it?
Oh, my comms team is going to be really mad at me.
Are they? Can we get credit that out later?
But it is, so it's just really exciting to me to think about, like, trust me, I'm not saying, oh, well, if we have more fires, then we have this great opportunity. No. I am turning, what is it, a silk purse out of a sow's ear? Like, this, it's bad.
Or, you know, or it's, you know, you're making chicken salad out of chicken shit, kind of.
Where is this going?
Sorry. I did grow up in Wyerton,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right.
You can take the boy out of the country, you can't take the country out of the boy.
But there are these opportunities to do something really magical.
Right. I heard a podcast last year where it was super interesting, and it was all about forest fires. And there was no consensus. Like, there was very little consensus. There were some very high-tech approaches in terms of analysis and mapping and projections on, like, where forest fires were going. And apparently they had pretty decent data, at least in the U.S., where they could say, if a fire starts, this is where it's going to go.
Oh, interesting.
Because of some of the things you just described. Because of been factory farmed, or it's been, you know, parts of it has been clear cut in this way, creates corridors or creates avenues where, like, fire, like, yeah, needs fuel and oxygen. And so if there are elements, if there's nothing in the way, right? If there's nothing in the way, and it's just like, this is just easily burnable, combustible, you know, tree mass, then it will just rip through it. That's super interesting to me. How do we feel, and I don't know if this is in your purview at all, but about us not really having much of a winter this year. Is this something that you're talking about in your office?
Yeah, I mean, all of us who work at WWF are human beings, you know, so it's very alarming.
Of course, you're like, amazing, winter. But then you're like, oh,
no,
crap.
This is not good. I'm a huge winter lover, and I take a week of vacation every February to go cross-country skiing near my home. I take vacation to do that. And this year, you know, my partner and I, we definitely picked the best week, but every single day it felt like it could have been the last day.
Right.
And the week after our vacation, there was no skiing. I have not skied in a week and a half. It's very, very alarming. I will say that, look, climate change news is really dark. It's very, very bad out there. And people are seeing it for themselves in a way that you cannot argue anything else. Like, let's even think about, we had a pandemic and we were told we had to stay indoors and, you know, we had to wear masks indoors and we had to only see people outside. And last summer, because of the smoke in many parts of Canada, we were told to stay inside and wear masks if we were outside. Like,
right.
Everything's backwards.
Right.
So it's dark, but we really, really try at WWF. Like, we're not into scare tactics about this because it's everywhere and people know. Like, you have to know. And the thing is, there are solutions, right? We actually could meet 30% of our Paris targets just by restoring and protecting at-risk nature. You know, back to this carbon and nature thing. That's a real solution that can be done. That doesn't involve, like, let's put mirrors in the sky and reflect the sun's rays, right? Like, no, we know how to do this.
That's only in China. That's the Chinese are all about building space lasers to back to Earth.
Well, yeah. So we're really, really focused on, you asked how we're doing at WWF about it. Like, we are super focused on what the solutions can be, and we have to be. Otherwise, like, we just wouldn't survive this work.
Right.
And we want to also let other people know that there are solutions too. I don't think we're being Pollyanna. We're not like, oh, everything's going to be fine. I don't know if everything's going to be fine. But we, you know, we say often, there's this thing that we say to ourselves often, there's a line in front of us that we can't cross. On the other side of that line is a world that is 4 degrees warmer, a million species extinct, unrecognizable future. But that line is still in front of us and we can still turn back. Right. So we really concentrate on the fact that that line's in front of us. We're really close to it. We're really close to it, but we can still turn back.
Just don't cross the line.
Yeah.
Just don't cross the line. Sounds simple enough. You commented, I think, on LinkedIn not so long ago that the most common question you get in public settings is the, what can I do? What can I do? And you gave some direction on that. But, you know, in this forum where we're quite comfortable swearing and talking about our previous university careers, what do people do? What would you tell me to do outside of, like, stop swearing on my podcast? What would you? Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that.
There are things that we can all do. I'm going to suggest a WWF one, and I'm going to suggest it on another organization.
Perfect.
So we've just been talking about how plants store carbon. Those plants are also habitat for wildlife. Huh. We're a wildlife organization. We care about this. If I look out my window, you know, I see an apartment building. That apartment building is built on habitat. Used to be habitat. My house used to be on habitat. Office, school, everything used to be habitat. So can we look at this landscape and think about, well, what could I contribute to make it habitat again? And it can literally start with one plant. So if you plant one native plant, a plant that is native to your area, whatever, it's one plant. What if your neighbor does one plant? And what if their neighbor, what if you've got kids in school and you're like, let's do planting of native plants in the schoolyard. All of a sudden you have habitat for monarchs. Monarchs are then eaten by the birds. Sorry, they are. It's a circle of life.
Monarchs are eaten.
The birds are, you know, scattering seeds and creating more habitat that creates little dens for rabbits that then, you know, feeds the wolves again. Nature's dark. But so we have something called regrow, like regrow. And you can actually, like, get tips on what your native plants are for your area. And then you can put in, like, I planted a purple coneflower on my balcony.
Nice.
Pollinators can go up to 7 stories, so it matters. And you can see how your actions ladder with your neighbors and see, like, oh, we are actually contributing plant by plant. So that's something that we're doing. It's a small piece, but it gets you, for me, when I registered, it really got me thinking about my built environment differently and seeing opportunities.
Right.
I will also recommend an organization called My Climate Plan. And they do all kinds of really interesting work where they help you as an individual human being. They look at, like, where you live in the country, and they talk to you about ways that you can lower your own GHGs through...
What's a GHG?
Greenhouse gas. Thank you. Through insulation, what programs are available, what does a heat pump look like? So it's that kind of stuff. But they have a really great monthly newsletter. So even if you just sign up for the newsletter, it's called The Advocate. And it's once a month. And once a month, they will give you a thing you can do. It might be signing a petition. I think they have a petition right now for low-income energy efficiency. It might be writing a letter to your counselor. Like, so sometimes you're like, I don't know what to do. You can trust My Climate Plan.
Right.
They will give you good information. And you can be like, oh, yeah, they're telling me to do this. Check, I'll do that. Right? These are small, simple things, but they really matter.
I mean, I like both those things. But I really like the plant... a plant that's indigenous to your neighborhood, your surroundings. It does sound a little like it's a 1980s shampoo commercial, because you're like, you plant a plant and then your neighbor plants a plant and they plant two plants and so on. Like there's a real, you're like, you could probably build an 80s spoof commercial about your plant that would go viral. Amy says she can make anything go viral. I don't know. She commented on that. So you might want to talk to her.
Viral to her 40.
Hey. Hey, there's a lot of nerds following Amy. A lot
of them. It's true. Yeah, it's an army. Yeah, we are part of the nerd army.
Yes, Megan Leslie. Leave Amy alone. But no, I think it's funny because that would kind of take off again. Both my wife and I grew up in and around Wyerton. We now have a property up there. And we are in love with the Monarchs. So we are always trying to replant it. I mean, my allergies hate this so much, but we're always replanting the milkweed. Like we're always replanting the milkweed. And then I'm just probably consuming a toxic amount of antihistamines to tolerate that. But it's worth it. It's worth it for me and the Monarchs.
Yeah.
I also have another animal that I'm curious about that I'd love to talk to you about. Bats.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about bats? Do you know much about bats?
Well, I do have a law degree and not a wildlife biology degree. We love bats.
Do you love bats?
Yeah, they're in trouble.
They're in trouble with the nose fungus.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
This is about the extent of my knowledge, okay? They're in trouble.
I built a bat box, but I haven't been able to attract any bats to my bat box yet.
A Wildlife Conservation Society, WCS, Wildlife Conservation Society. They're a real science-y-based organization around wildlife, and they just put out a little paper about proven best practices for bat habitat.
Nice.
Admittedly, little dense. I was like,
I'm not opposed to, I mean, I downloaded your PDF, so, right? So I'm not opposed to some dense reading. I'll take a look at that. I wanted to, because I had this idea, and it was, if somebody was daring me, I have this idea of creating my own, maybe not for profit of a sort. I want to just call it, I fucking love bats and promote bat, you know, rehabilitation, bat habitats, bat houses.
Team up with WCS, they'd be into that.
They'd be into the, I fucking love bats?
Yeah. We do.
The Inland Maine. I think I own the.
God, that's amazing. We do this little granting project where we give out very small micro grants to schools that want to do habitat or wildlife initiatives. And it's amazing how many classes in elementary schools do bat houses. We fund a bunch of them. It's not called I Fucking Love Bats because it's.
But it could be.
No, you've got that domain.
It could be. And your letter, I also enjoyed your, Megan Leslie says, the letter on your website as well, the look back and the look forward. So what is, what's the plan for WWF for 2024? We're still pretty early in it. So what's the game plan?
Yeah, it's a continuation. So we have a 10-year plan called Regenerate Canada, and, it really is. It's 10 years because, you know, a lot of places will have like a 3-year strategic plan. Well, we're not making widgets. We're not like responding to the market. It's like we got to do conservation. We got to do protection. We got to do restoration. And we got to do carbon sequestration. So we have this big 10-year timeline to 2030. And we've had some incredible success. Like I mentioned, this work with Shipwemekulu Restoration and Stewardship Society. We're taking that to a new level. They are powerhouses of planting, like the ability of them to plant in their territory, the number of plants is staggering. So we're continuing to support that work, working with Catesy First Nation in Interior BC. They're in the Fraser watershed, and Catesy believe that salmon are their ancestors, and salmon are disappearing and have disappeared from a lot of their creeks on their territory that would have been spawning creeks. For lots of reasons, including poor forestry practices in the forest around a creek. You know, the trees are gone, the water warms up because it's not shaded, the landslides happen, making it shallower because there's no roots to hold the land in place, right? So it's amazing thinking about how forestry is impacting salmon. So we're doing some creek restoration with them, deepening the channels, planting along the banks to hold those banks in place, planting trees to shade. It's really powerful stuff. And the first creek we did, this was a couple of years ago, we just did this one section of a creek. No word of a lie. The next year, the salmon were there. Like not in great numbers, but the salmon came back, right? You know, nature heals. It really does.
It's funny when you say creek, because two things come to mind. Is one is I've had a debate for a long time with my wife about, is it creek or is it crick?
Crick, yeah.
Is it crick? She's convinced it's crick. She's wrong.
Is she from the Ottawa Valley? Where's she from?
She's not. I mean, she grew up in the same area, so it's weird, right? Then I also think of Dawson, and it's the, you know, is it, you wouldn't last a day on the creek. You couldn't. Anyway.
Pacey to be like a spokesperson for the sign up Katie Holmes.
I mean, he is Canadian, right? Like, isn't he Canadian? Isn't one of them's Canadian? So one of those Creek boys was, yeah. Are you looking for spokespeople?
Do you need like a former 90s heartthrob?
Could you imagine? I think we're good.
Probably who you want is Ryan Reynolds. Like,
well,
you're going to go all out. I think you want to.
For the true Canadian idol representative experience, absolutely.
I mean, Nathan Fillion is probably cheaper, but. I
don't know who that is.
Exactly, right? No. So they were both Canadian actors. They were both. So this is, you know, why are we talking about this? No good reason. They were both on the Two Girls, a Guy at a Pizza Place.
I have read about that in the news because I am not actually in touch with popular culture, but I read about it.
I mean, but that isn't that how you get in touch with popular culture? I think there was a Ryan Reynolds got an award, and as part of the award ceremony and among the multitude of people who came to sing his praises, Nathan Fillion was there.
Nice.
Is there anything else you want to talk about that you want to bring up, that you want to share with my listener?
I mean, what I would share with your listeners is, yeah, there's some pretty dark stuff out there, but there are solutions. You know, join us, join others. Like there are lots of great groups out there doing really awesome work. So think about supporting them, signing up for their newsletters, things like that. It's really important. And we're doing great work, you know, yes, I'm supposed to say that.
That's what your comms team did approve.
Yes. We are doing, very good work.
We did great work. There's more work to do. Yeah. Is that the, I think that,
join us.
Yes.
But like, we are doing great work. Like, listen to the inflection in my voice. We are doing great work.
I believe you. Well, it's true. What you're saying is there's optimism.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's not about WWF, right? It's like we, the collective we. There's great stuff happening out there, and there is a reason to be optimistic. So that's what I would want to say. And I guess my parting question would be, like, 50% of your guests have been from Kirkland Lake, Ontario, which
I know. Well, you know, no, that's, yes. There's, is there anyone else I should?
Alan Thick.
Is he available? Can you get me? Can you put me in touch with Alan Thick? I'm not sure. We can we'll fact check that later. If that's your other celebrity. That's my
other suggestion.
It's like you, Amy, and Alan Thick.
Totally on the same. Like, Jesus.
I had forgotten that was true. It's so funny, right? Because. I've said to some people, trying to book people for your podcast is like herding cats. It is like herding cats. And so there are other people who I would like to interview, but I got to you and Amy first. So, I got to you and Amy first. And so let me know if there's anyone else in Kirkland Lake that I should, maybe we could, over the course of an entire podcast, I could just interview everyone who was ever born and lived in Kirkland Lake. That could be its own podcast, just like the Kirkland Lake, you know, diaries. And we could talk about how great it is to cross country ski in the area, or
No, we skidoo there.
Okay.
Human propelled. Oh,
snowmobile, skidoo. What is the? All right. Okay, I'll allow it. Well, Megan, it's been really lovely catching up with you. Thank you for this.
Thank you. What a treat.
How was that? That was great. I enjoyed that conversation with Megan so much. I spent a lot of time thinking about the carbon bomb after we recorded this. Those words really stick with you, carbon bomb. Also, good things to do, right? So plant plants that make sense for your geography, for wherever you are, no matter if you're in a house or an apartment or several stories up, that's still useful. And my climate plan, check that out. You can just Google that. Also, you know, apologies to the family of Alan Thicke. Alan Thicke did, in fact, pass away. So I know we made some Alan Thicke jokes there at the end, but no disrespect. I loved him when he was on TV. I did also Google and find the entire list of other famous people from Kirkland Lake. I might try and track a couple of them down. I don't think a similar page exists for Wyerton, but maybe one day that'll exist. Thanks, Megan, for doing that. Thanks for joining me. Also, thanks again to my friends Dark Tapes for the music for this podcast. And if you want to hear some of the other things I have to say, mostly automotive or automotive adjacent, sign up for my newsletter at growdy.wtf, growdy.wtf. That's it. Thanks, folks.